Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina. And every once in a while, Michael, the Open Floor Globe members step up and they try to get us in trouble. And this is going to be one of those opportunities. There is no question about it, because we got a huge, big-time question from Harry right off the top that's going to guide today's discussion. He writes, Michael Pina loudly and correctly exposed Michael Jordan's spectacular move as one of the most overrated highlights, quote-unquote, in NBA history. In that vein, I want you guys to rank these NBA figures in terms of how outsized their praise and reputation are compared to their actual achievements. I've got a Mount Rushmore of the most overrated in the NBA, Harry says. Here he goes. Mike D'Antoni, number one. The revolutionary genius coach has zero finals appearances, despite coaching some of the biggest names in the game and regularly being listed among the best coaches in the league. Number two, Harry says, the Celtics' big three. Three Hall of Famers, a Hall of Fame coach, one title. With as much adulation as this group gets, you would think nine of the Celtics' titles belong to them instead of one solitary ring. A decade later, and we still have to endure cries of, if we would have had Kendrick Perkins. Look, if your dynasty swings on the availability of Kendrick Perkins, it's not a real dynasty. Number three, Harry writes, Chris Paul. The constant arguments of where he stands in the pantheon of greatest point guards is tiresome. Fairly or unfairly, point guards are measured by winning and leadership. Zero finals appearances, a history of not being there when it matters most, and a leadership style that at best can be described as abrasive. Number four, Reggie Miller. 18 points, 3 rebounds, and 3 assist averages for an all-time great. 3 total MVP votes for his entire career. Never was on the first or second team All-NBA. All you're going to find is a few third team All-NBA appearances. He wasn't known for his defense or being a glue guy. What am I missing here? Just because he was supposedly clutch? He could be in the Hall of Good, maybe. Hall of Memorable, without question. Hall of Fame, I don't see it. So Harry is using his quarantine period, Michael, to just absolutely take haymakers at everybody. Let's just call him Haymaker Harry. Now, it does seem like some of these nominations, though, Michael, are pointed directly at you. Of course, the Celtics, a team that's very close to your heart. Of course, Mike D'Antoni, very close to heart, a guy that you said recently you would want to play for. And then also Chris Paul, somebody who you've praised here, and rightfully so. I mean, Chris Paul has deserved the praise this season. So, are you going to take up Harry on his ranking procedure. Who is the most overrated of those four? And give me your order.
This is such an outrageous cast right here to call these people overrated. Come on, Harry. If I have to rank them, just because I respect all of them so much, and I mean, it's really difficult. I would say that Reggie Miller is the one who kind of sticks out a little bit as the sore thumb here. I don't think that Reggie Miller is overrated relative to the other people who are listed here. I'm just going to have to pick him. I mean, I can see the argument, and I actually didn't know that he'd never made a first or a second team All-NBA. That's pretty bad on the resume and the all-time resume. But he also hit some of the bigger shots, and, you know, there's the legendary ending against the Knicks, the rivalry with Spike Lee. He had some big performances against Michael Jordan on a big stage. So, I mean, I'm now trying to like validate his as being underrated. But if I had to just pick one, it would be Reggie Miller is the most overrated. And then the other three, I can't even like engage in this. this disrespect.
Okay, so here's the tricky part about the overrated conversation. We should set some ground rules. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there is no international rating body for basketball, right? So we're all sort of taking perceived reputations based off probably NBA Twitter, based off of, I guess, articles or podcast discussion, or just sort of the reputations that maybe have congealed over the years. And one thing that I always take into account when I'm looking at like overrated or underrated is just volume of discussion, right? Like to mm-hmm. me, there should be sort of a relationship between how important you are and how much conversation that you generate. And that's not always a direct relationship, right? There's absolutely certain things like, I mean, you go back to like J.R. Smith is an easy example. We spent an awful lot of time for lots of years talking about J.R. Smith. And like, he is not a guy who's even going to be in the conversation for the Hall of Fame ever, right? But he was, discussed just repeatedly. And so to me, that kind of a thing winds up getting a player or a team or or an organization into that overrated category. So that's sort of the standard that I use, Michael. I was with you for pretty much everything that you said about Reggie Miller, but I've got to say, I'm coming right at you. The most overrated of these four things is the Celtics big three, Michael. Come
that
on.
That is, I knew you were going to say that.
Can I ask you, in the spirit of an olive branch, can I ask you, obviously that you really revere Kevin Garnett, rightfully so. Yes. You really revere Paul Pierce and Rajon Rondo, rightfully so. But does a little bit of you understand the nitpicking that goes on towards these guys, knowing that their window was fairly narrow in terms of how long they were together, and they did only have the one title, the two finals appearances? Like, if you compare them side by side, and this is sort of what I meant with the volume of discourse, the internet never discusses the Detroit Pistons, except every once in a while there's like a charity conversation about the Pistons, right? But they were going to the Eastern Conference Finals every single year. They won a title, surprised everybody. They're not hallowed. People don't hold up their starting five as one of the greatest units of all time. They're not considered, you know, like the kind of the standard bearer for an era of defensive excellence. Like, nobody really celebrates or like, you know, glorifies them in any way. But on the flip side with the Celtics, and some of it is earned, these guys are legitimate Hall of Fame players, but these guys get glorified just to a crazy degree. Like, if I had to say the amount of discussion compared to those two organizations, which were pretty similar in terms of overall team performance during the entire era, wouldn't you say the Celtics probably get 100 times more attention than the Pistons do?
Yeah, that's really fascinating, because the way you looked at those Pistons teams in the mid-2000s, I mean, when I think about them, I think they do get a lot of credit as, you know, that standalone team that won the title without a top five, top 10 player on the roster. So I think they do get a lot of credit. Granted, it's not even close to the volume of discussion that the Celtics get when they form the big three. But I think that that's deserved, just because the ceiling on that Celtics team was so much higher than any of those Pistons teams that either won the title or went to the championship. So
okay, fair. So defend your Celtics honor. Why are they not overrated? Why are they, I mean, properly rated? You're not going to go so far to say that are they underrated?
They 100% underrated. No. I mean, okay, so when they first formed, the window was like 1 or 2 or maybe 3 years, right? And instead they stretched it to, I think you could say, a good solid 5 seasons of pseudo title contention. And, you know, they win the very first year, which, as we've seen, you know, when LeBron went to the Miami Heat, struggled in the first year in the finals. Other teams kind of coming together in the initial foray, typically don't, you know, romp through the regular season. I think they won 66 games that year. Their chemistry was great. They struggled a little bit in the playoffs. You know, that Atlanta Hawks team took them to 7. LeBron took them to 7 in a classic series. And then they beat the Pistons in 6 in the Eastern Conference Finals to go to the championship. So I think that was very impressive on their part. And I think, like, look, when you win a championship, you can't be called overrated. It is so difficult to win the title. And for them to go to 2 championships, to 2 finals series in 3 years, you know, I get the Kendrick Perkins torn ACL, and, you know, if he played, they probably would have won that series. But the way I look at it is that in 2009, they were... I'm looking this up on the fly right now. They were 27-2 heading into a Christmas Day rematch against the Lakers that season. They were even better than they were the previous year when they won the championship, which you don't even really see very often. And Kevin Garnett, they were so good.
Yeah. Kevin Garnett was barking on the court. You know, he was getting down and acting like a dog on the court because there was literally no one who could stop them, right? And they had intimidated the entire league. And all the young backup point guards around the league who are facing Kevin Garnett down on all fours, barking and screaming and hooting and hollering, are sitting there like, oh my God, am I even going to be able to get the ball across the line, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the other factors is, look, they were influential in a lot of ways. You go from Tom Thibodeau's defensive coverages, the strong side, over-helping. He took to Chicago and had a lot of success with Joakim Noah, and then a lot of teams around the league basically copied that strategy on the defensive end for years. And I think even more importantly, just the concept of a big three. Now, they were not the first, you know, super team or anything like that. I'm not going to credit them in that way. But they did inevitably push LeBron James from Cleveland to Miami, where we did see kind of a proliferation of all-stars trying to team up to win championships. Because he's not going to Miami if Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen never come to Boston. That's just, I think he is going to win championships, or at least one in Cleveland during his time there.
It's a great point. Kevin Garnett's the original ring chaser, right? Okay,
yeah,
that's
what I was saying. Yeah,
that was a joke on my behalf. You're right, though. I mean, they have a very formative role in changing the era from Michael's like always a Bull, Tim Duncan's always a Spur, Kobe's always a Laker, into, hey, there's a new attitude towards what players can and should do and how teams should be constructed. And even just like how you should allocate your salaries, right? Like pay top dollar for your very best players and just try to find the very best role guys you can around them and go forward that way. Like they're a bridge between those two eras for sure.
And just to cap it off real quick, like I don't think they get enough credit post 2010 for how good they were and how competitive they were, particularly against those Miami Heat teams. I mean, there were some series where, you know, there was the Rondo series where his elbow snapped when he was thrown to the ground viciously by that dirty scoundrel, Dwayne Wade. there was, you know, I think Rondo in particular and how he elevated himself, he had some just ridiculous performances in the playoffs, and they pushed LeBron to have, in my opinion, the greatest game of his career, Game 6. And I think it was 2012 against the at the Garden, obviously against the Celtics, when he just went absolutely bananas. So I think their place in NBA history, because of their relationship with LeBron James's career, is just so much more pronounced than anything that the Detroit Pistons did, when you just kind of look back at what really matters in the history books.
You made a very, very compelling and layered case. I'm impressed, Michael. We're going to have to split the difference here, because you guys still get way too much talk, man. I mean, people really fixate, and it doesn't help that both KG and Paul Pierce and now Kendrick Perkins have all gone into media roles. I think that, and Doc obviously is just a nonstop one-man media machine. I think that's a big part of why they're always going to be sort of overrated in my eyes. It's like, these guys know how to shout from the rooftops with bugles about their own greatness, and they're not afraid to do it. And of course, that's going to rub a lot of people the wrong way. I don't blame them for doing it, but I do think that it kind of contributes to the volume of the noise around that team. Okay, if you have to say number two most overrated among Mike D'Antoni, Chris Paul, or I guess you didn't pick the Celtics yet, which of those three entities are the most overrated?
I mean, I think we're splitting hairs at this point, but I'll just go with Mike D'Antoni, who I do not think is overrated in the slightest. I think when I generally look at people across the NBA, I find them to be either underrated or properly rated. I don't think too many people are overrated, and I know we're going to get to that in a little bit, and I'm about to dispel and trash the sentence that I just uttered. But with D'Antoni, like, look, I understand that he did not win a championship, but as I already stated, winning titles is incredibly difficult, and we should not judge any one individual in a team game on that basis alone, particularly a coach. I have a couple just all-time career playoff records that I'm going to read, and it kind of just let you know how difficult all this is. So D'Antoni is 49-49 in his career in the playoffs as a head coach. Rick Carlisle is 58-62. Doc Rivers is 84-83. So I look at that and I'm kind of like, these guys are basically all 500. D'Antoni was exactly 500, is exactly 500. He could have won the title in 2018 if Chris Paul did not pull his hamstring. He could have won in 2007 when the championship was wide open for the taking in that series against the Spurs, and Steve Nash gets hip-checked into the scorer's table, and basically everyone gets suspended from the next game on Phoenix's side just for stepping onto the court and breaking a totally draconian rule. So, I mean, it's like he just had a lot of bad luck. But the man revolutionized the sport, or at least he helped revolutionize the sport and how those Phoenix Suns teams played. And then even coming to Houston and really kind of unleashing James Harden the way he has, finding ways to make it work with Russell Westbrook when a lot of people said it could never work, finding ways to make it work with Harden and Chris Paul when people before that partnership took place and had so much success, people doubted that ability to thrive. So I don't know. I think that if you're a head coach, it's a lot of it is dictated by the players you have and the talent around you, and your job is just to kind of not screw it up. And I don't think D'Antoni has ever really screwed it up.
I have two defenses for D'Antoni. Number one, I think that he gets a lot of the philosophical credit that you were talking about, the importance of the role of the Celtics in their era. I think D'Antoni, like, even if he never wins, he is going to be held up for pace and space, right? And making sure that that became kind of the predominant style, shifting everything towards that direction and being way early on it. And being early on it at a time where he was getting mocked ruthlessly, questioned relentlessly. Everybody was kind of saying he's backwards for years and years and years. And just he stuck to his guns, and he wound up being on the right side of the history. History bent towards him. And I think that from that standpoint, you get to call him a visionary, even if it never paid off with the title. And like, he just kind of gets to have that card. In terms of the records, the postseason records, his would look a lot better if you took out his head-to-head matchups with Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich, right? I mean, his postseason record's looking real good without those head-to-head showdowns with those coaches and those great teams. And so one reason why I give him a little bit of a pass, and I wouldn't rush to call him overrated, I'm definitely not as high on him as you are. I hear the concerns about, oh, does he only care about offense, not defense, and all that stuff. And I definitely hear the point loud and clear from Harry, who's saying, look, this guy's had a lot of talent. Like, at some point, he should have broken through. To me, though, it's like the classic. He's like Barkley, or he's like Stockton. He's like Gary Payton, you know, going against like legit dynasties. I don't really think there's shame in losing to the Warriors at their peak or losing to Tim Duncan's Spurs, right? And a lot of the, you know, the postseason losses along the way for D'Antoni have come to teams of that ilk, right? And so, like, okay, you're second to all-time greats. Like, that's not, you know, some huge you know, thing that we're, you know, like, you have to wear a scarlet letter, loser, you have an L on your chest because you couldn't get past Duncan and Steph Curry, Kevin Durant. It's okay. All right. I think that we've gone through his list pretty thoroughly. I actually agree with a lot of what you said about Reggie Miller as well. I think one reason why Miller gets elevated was because his teams were so consistently good and he was just kind of the face of them, right? Like, it wasn't Reggie and the millionaires, sort of like it was Jordan and the Jordanaires, right? I mean, that team was so balanced. They were big, all five positions, great point guard, great center. They were together forever. They would fight you to the death. They were super annoying. They were always on national TV, it seemed like, going against the Knicks or the Bulls, like you're mentioning. And he just happened to be the high scorer. He wasn't, you know, like by far and away their best player. It actually kind of parallels a little bit what happened with the Pacers later when Paul George is sort of like the face of those Pacers team. But really, I think of those Pacers teams as being that five-man unit as well, right? Like George Hill, Roy Hibbert, they're kind of clamping you together as a team defensively. And so why we remember Reggie and none of his teammates, you know, I do think that's a little bit unfair to the rest of those guys, and maybe does prop him up a little bit in the historical conversation. All right, now we're going to get to the main course here, though, Michael, which everyone's been waiting for. You and I are going to reveal our most overrated players, coaches, organizations, whatever else in the NBA universe. And I believe you've got a list, and I really hope. I better not be on your list, Michael. You're not going to take shots at me, are you?
Not in this episode, no.
Okay, good. Whew. Okay, all right. Your list is sounding great so far. All right, what you got? Give me your most overrated people.
Yeah, so again, I want to just preface this by saying that, like, generally when I look at players and coaches, I find that they're either properly rated or underrated. And just my general stance in evaluating guys is I want to, you know, look to see who deserves more credit than they're currently getting, or,
all right,
or is underpaid.
Stop. Stop right there. You don't even need to do the wind up, okay? This is
okay.
This is quarantine radio, okay? Everybody knows that we're here to keep it real. Everyone knows we're not trying to slight people. This is a conversation not about whether someone's good or bad. It's whether they're getting too much attention or acclaim by the masses, who we can't even define, as I said earlier, because we don't know who the masses are. It could change every moment. It's completely dependent upon who you specifically follow on Twitter and what information you consume. This is a personal opinion. It's not a character attack. Michael, take it away.
I have a question for you. Should I start with the bigger names and work my way down, or just kind of go through it? Okay.
Swing for the fences. Give me your best one. Give me your heater.
Okay. The first one is Kyrie Irving. And
yes.
I'm partially throwing his name out here to plug a piece I just wrote about him on SB Nation, wondering if we'd ever get to see his peak, or if his peak is already past us. And look, I'll listen to anyone arguing that he's overrated. I'll listen to people arguing that he's underrated or properly rated or whatever, what have you. When I look at Kyrie Irving, especially over the past 3 years, in kind of digging into the numbers with him, I just can't help but see someone who has a long way to go for him to kind of reach the level of acclaim that he receives from so many of his adoring fans. And the fact that he was kind of still a no-brainer max contract recipient by the Brooklyn Nets, and I think any other team in the league that had cap space would have, and a need at point guard, would have also paid him that much money. But I think that it deserved a little bit more of kind of a deeper analysis than just it being a no-brainer. So from that perspective,
Michael, yeah. for once, we're perfectly aligned. I mean, I think everybody out there who's been listening to me for years understands that this would be my nominee. I think it's a classic case of his best moments came on such a big stage, and he was so good that he wound up having that be his new baseline for expectations. And that's unfair to him. It's unfair to all of us. That guy was so darn good in the 2016 finals for that week, outplaying Steph Curry, putting up crazy performances in the clutch, big-time comeback, historic title for the Cavaliers and everything else, that he winds up getting, you know, this super clutch label. He winds up being the big-time playoff performer. He could be a franchise player now. He can go and have his own team and all this other stuff. And you look at the injuries, you look at the reliability, you look at the leadership personality, you look at the off-court comments, and just is he capable of being that, you know, personality? You look at the defense, you look at the ball dominance. Those are all major, major questions, and we've got years' worth of answers about the impact that stuff has on his teammates. No one's denying he's a brilliant offensive player. No one's denying he's a brilliant scorer and just an incredible ball handler and everything else. But there's more to the game than the stuff that Kyrie Irving does very, very well. And I think that he's the perfect kind of person to become overrated because he's fun to watch when he's got it going. And it's very easy to see his genius when he's playing well. Now, when he's playing poorly, he's also an easy thing to kind of excuse away. Oh, it's not a big moment, right? Oh, you know, he does so much on offense, he doesn't need to try hard on defense. And that's really not the right standard or the right framework to be judging these players. I think he just gets automatically grandfathered on to like every USA basketball team. He's always considered or like voted in almost every year as an all-star starter. And I just don't think he's on that level consistently as a player. You know, I think there's guys like, you know, Damian Lillard or other, you know, point guards sort of in that range who have surpassed him and maybe don't get enough credit for it.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said about Kyrie. And, you know, in kind of looking through his career resume for the article that I wrote, if I were to ask you, Ben, how many times do you think Kyrie finished top 10 in points per game in his entire career? And how high did he finish when he finished at the highest point of his career? What would you guess?
I would say maybe he's got zero top five appearances and maybe one top 10.
You are correct. He has zero top five finishes. He has two top 10 finishes in points per game. And the highest he ever finished was in 2018, his first year with the Celtics, eighth place. So that kind of was a little bit jarring for me. And we should say that he did average, I think, 27 a game or something like that this year, but he only played in 20, so he did not qualify for the leaderboard. But when I kind of look back at him and try to find out what his apex was or anything like that, I do always, and I think a lot of people will agree, go back to the 2016 finals when, you know, he had that 41-point back against the wall performance in game five. On 24 shots, just like a ridiculous incandescent night for anybody and would headline anyone's resume. And I kind of have always thought that his step back three over Steph Curry was the best thing that ever happened to him. And now, years removed from it and everything that's happened since, I'm kind of thinking that it was the worst thing that ever happened to him. It's kind of like a curse at this point. Would you agree with that?
No, I hear you. That's what I mean. It raised the bar for him so high, but I also think it gave his defenders, you know, enough ammunition to defend him forever, right? Like, he almost got into this, like, legendary category from that standpoint. So, to me, it's a gift and a curse. Obviously, it's going to be the most cherished moment of his career. I guess when I just look forward, when we're starting to, like, you know, pick out who are the guys who can lead title teams, who are the players that you really have to kind of account for when you're saying, you know, true contenders or, you know, stars in that absolute A-list level, to me, I think a lot of people put Kyrie into that category still, and I just don't. All right, let's shift gears. Who else you got, Michael?
Okay, I think this one's going to offend you a little bit, and
Don't say Giannis. Never.
That's for our offline conversations only. It's Draymond Green. And
no, totally fair. And I'm Draymond's one of his most diehard defenders, but the overrated, underrated meter swung hard the other direction over the last 12 months. But continue.
I gotta say, I think that you might have contributed to that a little bit just in my own psyche because of your work back in the day doing the top 100. Whenever he was near the top 10, or I think he, what was the highest he ever finished? I'm pretty sure he finished in the top 10 at least one of those years, or consistently, right?
I think he was in between 10 and 15 for like four straight years, probably. Like probably right around 11, 12 might have been the highest. Maybe 10. I don't know if he ever got up to 10, but he was right in that range. And by the way, don't go and retroactive this, Michael. Okay, he deserved to be there when he was there. It's just that he hit a cliff pretty hard this year.
So when I was reading those in real time, I thought that that was, I think laughable might be a little offensive, but I was laughing.
Wow.
I'm sorry. And I think he's an all-time intelligent player. He's an all-time defender. He helped unlock the small ball revolution and changed how we view basketball. So, giving credit where credit is due for sure. But it's always been just so difficult for me to, and for everybody, to separate when he was in his prime, to separate everything that he did during the playoffs on huge stages from the fact that he played with the greatest backcourt in NBA history, and then he called Kevin Durant and begged him to climb aboard the Warriors and then chased Kevin Durant away a couple years later. I just think you have to factor all that in, and at the end of the day, his inability to put the ball in the basket kind of matters. Scoring does matter. He brought a lot to the table with all of his intangibles and everything, and still does. But it was always just such a perfect fit that coalesced brilliantly. And looking at these guys kind of in a vacuum, I just never thought that he was on that level personally. But so that's why I throw him here.
No, I mean, definitely you're trending towards blasphemy here. You're right on the line, Michael, right on the line. I think that he fits so well with those guys because he could fit so well with lots and lots of types of guys because he does so many different things on both ends. I mean, unbelievable passer, high IQ, unselfish, mm-hmm. doesn't overshoot. Defensively can, you know, play multiple positions, cover almost every single guy in the league at his prime. And then also the ability to set tempo. You know, we saw it last year in the Western Conference Finals where he, you know, for a couple games there in Portland, basically ran them off the court single-handedly. His high level was really, really high. In his own way, he could almost orchestrate a game from that position, unlike very, very few big men can in this mm-hmm. age. So that's why I give him a lot of credit for that. But I have a related one that's a little bit of a heater. How do you feel about this? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Golden State Warriors ownership. I think that they are absolutely overrated. I'm guilty of contributing. You're calling me, you know, one of the leading overraters of Draymond Green here. But certainly, I bought everything Warriors owners were selling, you know, the Lightyear stuff. I mean, obviously, those comments came back to bite them. But when they're going out there and shelling out, you know, $1 billion for a brand new stadium, you know, they've got all these wine cellars in the Chase Center, and they're, you know, just going above and beyond personal butlers. It's like, okay, these guys are really changing the NBA economic structure. They're cashing all these checks. They're going to be able to have a dynasty year after year. They certainly believe that they were constructing something that was bigger than any individual player. And ultimately, they lost sight of the most important thing, which was talent is what wins the championships. You take away Steph Curry in terms of the health, they're the worst team in the league, and they're worse than, you know, also ran organizations like the Sacramento Kings and the Phoenix Suns. I thought it was supposed to be a light year situation, right? And that seems like the lights went out, actually. Now, in terms of their biggest mistake, they didn't bend over backwards and cater to Kevin Durant over these last couple of years. They thought, hey, we can massage it. We are who we are. We were good before him. We weren't good. We can be good after him. And that was just not the case. And again, I think it was their hubris, their own reputation kind of going to their head a little bit. They'd had an awful lot of success. Certainly, they were probably exhausted at some point because the seasons were so long and it all blurred together. But they mismanaged the Kevin Durant exit poorly, horribly, however you want to say it. They just didn't take care of business. And, you know, I still have trust that they're going to be able to pull this thing back together and potentially get back into contention. But that trust has a lot more to do with Steph Curry's abilities than it does to do with the Golden State Warriors ownership group. And you can see they're desperate and floundering like any other franchise. I mean, D'Angelo Russell, I mean, what a Hail Mary that was, right? Andrew Wiggins, it's another Hail Mary to undo a Hail Mary. And so I think from that standpoint, their reputation has come crashing back to earth. I'm not sure people still view them as like, you know, this pristine ownership group. I imagine they do because they've won so much. But to me, I think that the last couple of years have been a reminder about what truly is driving the winning. And you can do all this stuff around the edges. You can do everything right off the court. Like, ultimately, you need superstar level guys playing at the peak of their abilities to sustain a dynasty like they had.
Oh, it's such a simple recipe. You just need, like, as you said, you need a top seven, top eight player, top five player. Get as many of them in the door as you possibly can, and then do everything in your power to keep them. And ultimately, they failed. I
forgot one more point. They also kind of got swagger jacked by Steve Ballmer. You know, I think Steve Ballmer saw their blueprint and was like, guess what? I have 50 times more money than you guys do, and I'm about to take it to a completely new level. And now, you know, you have to wonder, are they going to still be able to compete? You know, you've got Ballmer coming in with a brand new arena, you know, potentially in a couple of years in Inglewood. You know, he's spending $1 billion plus on that thing. He swings for the fences last summer, gets himself the two superstar level guys that you need to have the foundation for a title team. It does seem like the power has shifted. And so from that standpoint, you know, I guess there is a little bit more cause for concern for Golden State.
That's a great point. If you're going to be a consistently successful ownership group, what you do is you spend money, you hire the right people, and you just get out of the way. You don't do interviews saying that you're light years ahead. You don't, as you said, create this culture where you're kind of susceptible to collapsing under the weight of your own hubris, which I think is what happened exactly. And I don't think that correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that the Warriors get enough blame for losing Kevin Durant in free agency. I mean, the whole point of signing him and having him for as long as possible and staying light years ahead is to keep him. And the second, I mean, he did re-sign, I guess, that first year, or he opted in or whatever happened. But, or I should say that last year. But to lose him in free agency, how they did, it takes two to tango. And honestly, he's a very mercurial personality, as we've come to learn and know. But your job is to bend over backwards to make sure that he is comfortable in every area of his life. And they failed in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, look, he bailed them out a little bit, right? Because he made such a bad decision by going to Brooklyn and teaming up with Kyrie that it was like so easy to focus on that part. But it did take the pressure off them, the fact that they had kind of botched that. All right, Michael, give me some more. You're overrated.
Okay, I'm gonna go down to someone who I don't even really feel is worth acknowledging, but I want to acknowledge, and that is Kyle Kuzma. I don't. We're gonna be real brief here. Are there people out here that out here still think that he is a above average NBA player? Besides Puma executives?
Well, I mean, two years in a row. Can I illustrate this for you perfectly?
Sure.
Right next to my barbershop in Inglewood, there is a mural. And the mural has a basketball in the center. And LeBron is, like, sticking out his hand to grab the basketball. Anthony Davis is sticking out his hand to grab the basketball. And Kyle Kuzma is sticking out, hand to grab the basketball.
That is exactly what I'm talking about right there. 2 years in a row shooting 30% beyond the arc. I have a quick little trivia question for you, Ben. Guess how many points Kyle Kuzma has scored in the clutch this season?
Wow. Is it over under 10?
You got to guess a number, homie.
Okay, 7.
12. 12 points.
I was pretty close. I mean, look, I'm out on Kuzma too. So I totally, and also, by the way, no offense, a lot of your questions are leading questions, Michael. You make it really obvious because you hate a guy and you're like, hey, you want a damning statistic why this guy sucks? Okay, here it comes.
Yeah, what can I say? Kuzma, not good. And I like, before the trade deadline, I was like, you know, trying to think of different hypothetical ways that the Los Angeles Lakers could move him to get more immediate help that made more sense. You know, there was one that I wish happened that would send him to the Pistons for Derrick Rose. That would have been a really neat trade that I thought would have boosted them quite a bit. And like, you tweet something like that out, or you write it or whatever, or you say it on a podcast, and people are like, Kuzma for Rose? Like, why would we ever give up on Kyle Kuzma? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, he's just not a very good basketball player, let alone his fit makes absolutely no sense with Anthony Davis and LeBron James. So I just wanted to point that out here and throw him on the barbecue.
It's a perfect one, because this is where I'm talking about volume, right? I mean, the Lakers media complex is gigantic. There's no question. Obviously, everyone in the Lakers fan base really wants Kuzma to be the guy they want him to be, right? And he's just not that guy. He also happens to be incredibly visible on social media, including Instagram, the haircuts, the outfits, everything else that adds to the whole thing. There is no question that he is overrated. And like, whenever the trade conversations came up, I was always asking myself, like, what teams really need Kyle Kuzma? Like, who's going to really want to give up something of value to get him? And I just, you know, I don't know which organization is out there that's super interested in that. Who else you got, Michael? Keep it coming.
Okay, so I kind of love this one. Jamal Murray of the Denver Nuggets.
Wow. Okay, this is interesting because Murray does have his group of haters. Like, there's a lot of people who are just like not in on him, think he's too unreliable, and mm-hmm. just kind of frenetic and hasn't proven it and isn't really that number two guy yet. I think you're one of those people.
Okay. No, and what really makes this whole exercise fascinating and fun is the reasons why you can call someone overrated or underrated or whatever. For me, it's the contract. And the kind of the milieu in which it was agreed upon. So, I mean, he gets that 5-year max from the Denver Nuggets at like the stroke of midnight when they can first offer it. And I was just like kind of flabbergasted, to be honest. Now, granted, you go back to that series against the Portland Trailblazers that they inevitably lost. And he had some ridiculous performances in that series a few years ago in the second round, like instant classic performances. He then just didn't make any noticeable improvement from his age 21 to his age 22 season this year. And I think you could make the reasonable case that he was arguably the fourth most valuable guy on that Nuggets team. And so I just... It's a little bit of it is unfair. You know, he's offered the money. He takes the money. No one's going to blame him for that. But I would have liked to see some sort of improvement from last year to this year, and we just did not get it.
Yeah, look, I've always been in the camp kind of defending him and pointing out that those good moments in the playoffs that you're describing happened at an awfully young age, right? And so mm-hmm. for a guy to be able to perform at that level so early in a high-pressure environment really speaks well for where this could go, right? We see so many guys don't even make the playoffs by the time they're like, you know, even 23 or 24 years old. Or if they do, they're playing smaller roles. And he was going head-to-head with, like, excellent backcourt talent and holding his own in those situations. And so that showed me a lot. It made me a lot more willing to accept that the glass was half full. But there's warts here for sure. I do think that the plateauing effect is unexpected, especially in situations where they're having other guys out for injury or whatever else. Or like, you know, a good example is Gary Harris falling off a cliff, right? Mm-hmm. What you want your number two guy in Murray to do in that situation is to be like, you know what? Gary Harris just flat out sucks this year. I don't know why. It's weird. It came out of nowhere, but guess what? That means I have to take 3 or 4 more shots a game, and if they're not the purest shots, oh well, I might have to force a little bit more going to the basket. I have to put more on my own shoulders. I'm now Robin to Jokic's Batman, right? That's sort of the mentality shit that you have to have, and I didn't necessarily see that from him this year, and I was a little bit disappointed by that. I'm not giving up on him, though. I also I kind of wonder with the overrated, underrated, does he really have that many stands like anymore? You know, it could be a situation where the glimmer has worn off from him a little bit, because I do find myself defending him a lot, and I feel like I don't have a lot of support on that one. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I'm out on a tree limb a little bit at this point. So I don't know. Maybe he's become a little bit of a favored punching bag.
Yeah, check back with me in like 6 months and he'll be underrated in my opinion. So that's just kind of how this goes. Everything changes so quickly.
So along the same line of younger players, I mean, what about, you know, my favorite guys? Devin Booker, D'Angelo Russell. I mean, this kind of crop of players who have gotten that all-star injury replacement, you know, asterisk, you can apply that or choose not to apply that if you don't want to. Who have sort of been elevated into that club, but maybe there's still, you know, a lot of question marks. Do they belong there? I feel like those are the type of players who really get overrated a lot. And I guess maybe the argument is if you flop some of those guys with Jamal Murray, they would have kind of similar situations where if they were on winning organizations, they could contribute, but maybe not enough to take teams over the top. But I feel like, you know, a lot of the things that you're saying about Murray in terms of whether it's plateauing or how much is he overall impacting things? I think those questions are even bigger for guys like Russell and Booker. And I feel like they get way more attention and hype because of their scoring numbers and because of their high moments at certain points than Murray does.
Interesting. I mean, first of all, I would separate. I think Devin Booker is in already a different tier than D'Angelo Russell. And so
does that tier ever finish above 13th in the Western Conference or no?
Oh my goodness gracious. I mean, Booker, we've already, I can't even go down this well with you, but
okay, you're right. People know how I feel about Booker, so you can leave Booker out of it. How do you feel about Russell?
I thought it was really interesting that Malik Beasley was better after the trade than he was in Minnesota. Look, if you want to say Russell's overrated, I think we're kind of at the stage now where because of the contract and because of just, I guess, his play with the Golden State Warriors as the starting point guard on the worst team in the league, that it's kind of what you said about Jamal Murray. Like, there's no real stands anymore for D'Angelo Russell. He's kind of fallen back to earth. And been properly rated, I would assume, and I would hope. That's kind of my read on him.
Okay, how about this, Michael? I got another nominee for you. I'm going to swing a little bit bigger. Tell me if you like this. Joel Embiid. What do you think? Is Joel
Embiid going there.
Overrated? Now, look, again, disclaimer applies, like I said at the beginning. I'm not saying he's bad. Joel Embiid is very, very good. But I think that the thing that people love to rush to is that he's the most talented player in the Eastern Conference. He could be the best player in the Eastern Conference, right? When he plays really well, his ceiling is that, right? There's no question. It's a factual statement. Like, when he is at his best, he, you know, is right there with Giannis or anybody else in that conference. I just think the problem is the consistency, the body, of course, the health factors. The reliability, the personality in terms of being a franchise-level guy. I mean, I love what he's doing off the court in terms of the donations and leading in that manner. Is he making his teammates better? I think it's a completely fair question. And then is his presence complicating life for his most important teammates in terms of making things more difficult for them? I think all of those are real legit questions. And, you know, I'm not trying to just completely bash the 76ers here, but another guy I would put in this category, frankly, is Tobias Harris. And again,
he's on my list. Yeah.
Nicest guy ever, right? But part of it is with the contract. And you look at like the trade package they put together in terms of how much they paid to get him, wild overpay. You look at the contract they gave him in free agency, wild overpay for a guy who's not really moving the needle in a major way from wins to and losses. And, you know, it was one of the ultimate nice guy hustles of all time. I mean, give him full credit for the finesse on Elton Brand to be able to, like, get that landing spot lined up and get that gigantic bag of cash in the summer while also somehow, you know, leading that organization to kind of push Jimmy Butler out the door. I mean, in hindsight, seems like a ludicrous series of decisions from them. But I think that, you know, ultimately, like, people really want Tobias Harris to be – the number three guy, you know, on a championship level team. And I just think he's underqualified to be that guy.
Tobias Harris was also on my list.
Let's stick to the big gun. What do you think about Embiid first?
Okay, yeah, I'm building up to that. I'm honestly a little flabbergasted that you dropped such a huge name and such a like undeniable talent. Like, no, as you said, I mean, granted, like no one is here to say that Joel Embiid is not good, but for me, it's kind of like he just so clearly has not lived up to what he could be. And it's very, very frustrating. Very frustrating. And I do think that, you know, he's been short-circuited by an incompetent front office and just a mishmash of skill sets that just do not complement him all that well. And that's a little frustrating. But that does not excuse coming into the season like out of shape entirely, like clearly, and then never really catching a stride and constantly being hurt and whining to the media and whining on social media and, you know, just statistically not making any leaps and declining in areas where it's just, well, it makes you scratch your head.
And like, so, talking trash to guys who aren't as good as him constantly, right? And then, okay, mm-hmm. Well, where are you when, you know, where are you in the playoffs, right? Like, are you walking the walk like you're talking the talk? I mean, that kind of stuff bothers me. Look, if he winds up leaving Philly, there's no question he's going to win the divorce. People are going to side with Embiid and look at Elton Brand and look back to Brian Colangelo and look at the ownership group, and there's going to be a million things. Remember when Embiid stepped up for the arena workers and the team employees and the owners didn't want to do it and he kind of guilt-tripped them? You know, remember when you know, they're saying all these weird things on burner accounts behind his back? Like, he's obviously going to win that divorce. But I think your point is accurate. Like, he's going to bear some responsibility if that entire situation doesn't wind up working out, right? Some of that is going to fall on his shoulders. I'm not sure he's going to be able to look back on his Philly tenure and say, look, I did everything perfectly. I have no regrets. I ran it as far as I could possibly go. This isn't like a LeBron in Cleveland in 2010 situation. You know what I mean? It's definitely different and more complicated than that.
No, for sure. But when you are, you know, coming into this season, you are saying that you're going to win the MVP and Defensive Player of the Year, and then you just, like, no-show in certain games against, like, legitimate opponents. It's just like, what are we even doing here? Like, you should be dominant. You should be in the conversation, honestly, with Giannis as the best player in your conference, and it's not even close. And the gap is, like, widening. So I get what you're going. It's weird that he didn't even like cross my mind for this exercise to say that he's overrated. He's just more frustrating to me.
Well, that's why I'm here, Michael, to set you straight. You know, that's my role on this show. No question. Who else you got on your list? And you mentioned you had Tobias.
Yeah.
Go on.
I mean, Tobias, it's more of the contract thing that you mentioned. And I think maybe either his team or the fan base just believing that he could be more of a playmaker, because it's obviously what they needed in that offense, someone who could run a pick and roll with either Al Horford or Joel Embiid, and that's just not his game. I mean, he's an efficient, nice scorer. He'll get you 20. He'll never take a night off, which is just really valuable and underrated, particularly with a team like Philadelphia and all the injury issues that they've had. But yeah, he kind of is not going to, in my opinion, ever be an all-star, and he's just paid more than a lot of guys who are, and that's unfortunate.
Okay, I threw you a bone with these two Sixers. I might have to come back at you with one that you're not going to be so pleased about, okay?
Oh, geez.
I think this is a case of a player going from underrated to overrated in a fairly short period of time period. It is Kemba Walker. What do you think?
Oh, geez. Can you? I mean, here's my case. Make the case for me.
Well, here's my case. Look, he's legitimately underrated in Charlotte the whole way through because no one's really ever going to talk about them. They're never on television. He's, you know, in a situation where ownership has never been, you know, excellent A-plus there under Michael Jordan. he's in a situation where his rosters have always been an absolute mess. He gets a lot of the hero ball credit for just putting, you know, really bad teams on his back, carrying them to the playoffs. And when they lose, he escapes all criticism because they weren't really supposed to win, right? I think that what we saw from the FIBA World Cup performance, and then even just the excitement kind of like coming into this season, just him being on the Celtics and being in a better situation, and oh, is he going to be able to be as good or better for the Celtics as Kyrie and everything else? I think it just built up a little bit too much attention. Like back in FIBA, I mean, when they really needed someone to save the day, he was nowhere to be found. Like he did not accomplish those goals in the biggest moments. And had you had another point guard of similar attention, whether it's Lillard or other guys on that level, I think that they would have performed better and had their team perform better than they did in that situation. Then you come into this season, of course, I mean, he's the ultimate darling story. There is no question about it. Like, all the bad energy is out in Boston. Here comes new good energy. He's fitting in with his teammates. And not only is he succeeding, but then guys like Tatum and Brown are able to find more comfortable roles. The chemistry's better. Everything's going along. I just looked ahead into the playoffs and said, do I trust Kemba Walker in these playoffs to be that guy? And the answer is no. And so quickly the conversation shifted to, oh, it's going to be Tatum's team. Tatum's going to do this, et cetera, et cetera. Because I think underlying that excitement around Tatum was the idea that if you are relying on Kemba to get through these Eastern Conference playoffs against top-level teams that have done it before, whether it's Toronto, Philly, or Milwaukee, like that's not going to play out well for you, right? Like if Kemba's your best player in a series, like you're probably going down to any of those teams. So okay, that's sort of my argument. I think that he gets too much nice guy shine. He gets too much of the green beer love. And I just think that he is not a top tier point guard, but people kind of want to force him into that conversation.
Okay. Okay. let me just start by saying that criticizing Kemba for showing up and participating in Team USA as the highest profile member of that team when no one else wanted to play, I don't think that that's fair to him at all. Like, you can't say, oh, Dame Lillard would have been on this team and they would have performed better. Well, it's like Dame Lillard could have showed up, but he had other priorities apparently. So I actually give credit to Kemba, or maybe not even credit. I just think that it was cool that he did play on that team.
Hey, look, I had to cover them here before they took off. I was very glad that he was there because there was not a lot of talented players there. I'm just saying, when I looked at the court, I was disappointed. I was expecting a gold medal from a Kemba Walker-led team. Even with that being the C team, you know, all the A-listers not even considering it, and the B-listers kind of dropping out one by one, I still thought they had enough talent to do it. And maybe I'm a little too old school, but when a team falls short of expectations like that, I do look to both coach and point guard. And I thought both Pop and Kemba just kind of let things down. You know, it just wasn't, yeah, well, it wasn't to the same level that I was expecting.
Now that we know what we know about Jason Tatum, obviously if he were healthy for that run, they would have blown everybody up by 45 points at least. But
well, and Kyle Kuzma too, right?
Sure, yeah, Kuzma. Still not recovered from that ankle injury. I think your point about Kemba being the best player, or thinking that he could be, or you know, concern about him being the best player on a team throughout an entire playoff run, you're screwed if that happens. I do agree with that for sure. I don't think that that is what the situation was in Boston heading into this year's postseason. I think a more fascinating question is just what he would have looked like in a playoff series against one of the better teams because of his deficiencies on the defensive end, and how much better the Celtics were on that side of the ball when he was on the bench. And I don't think they would have ever benched him in crunch time or anything like that. But there would be offense-defense substitutions, I think. And that's tricky for someone who's on a max contract, who is as good as he is, who played in the All-Star game. I think that there's also a little bit of recency bias here because of the knee injury that he had and how poorly he played in the All-Star game and down the stretch before the season was put on hiatus. But like, he was like great in a lot of performances for the Celtics this season, and his numbers are very impressive. And you really can't quantify the impact that he had on the locker room coming in to replace Kyrie Irving and that entire just volcano last year. But I think he did. I think he went above and beyond the high expectations that were set there. And I mean, he is a super nice guy. I don't know if you've ever talked to him, but he's like one of the nicest players in the whole league. So that's just
that's keeping it real. No, it is real, and that's why I think he gets slightly overrated, because media tends to fall in love with him a little bit. And I hear what you're saying about the locker room impact and all that. And I'm just saying, look, I just wanted to see it in the playoffs. I thought he was going to enter this postseason.
Same.
With more to prove than just about anyone. And I just, before we crown him, and I do think there's like a real tendency, especially among the Boston media, to prematurely crown guys. You know, Tatum was instantly like this top 10 postseason guy, like out of the gate, you know, after he had one really, really nice month, right? Kemba was going to be the replacement for, you know, Kyrie falls apart in the playoffs. Here's Kemba to save the day. And I just wanted to see it first. That's all. And again, I'm not trying to bag on this guy. He is a really, really nice guy. I just think that the pendulum just shifted a little bit too far and too fast for my liking. All right, Michael, we got time for a couple more if you've got them on your list. Who you got?
Okay. This guy, I'm not even sure if he's overrated, because I think the jury's out, but I'm including him anyway. Julius Randle.
Oh, yeah. I had him too. It's a great call. The focus on double-doubles, Michael, has always killed me. If that's what you're leading with as your great strength is, oh, I've got double-doubles, it's a big-time problem. This goes all the way back to the J.J. Hickson contract year explosion with the Portland Trailblazers, where he fooled everybody into giving him some money because he kept just randomly getting 12 points and 10 rebounds, and everybody called that this big dynamic energy game-changing type of guy. I feel like Randle is in a similar situation where I just hear about these empty stat double-doubles and none of it matters.
The guy finished the season averaging 20 and 10, and he might be, I don't want to say he's the worst player in the league or anything like that, because that's not nice. But if I'm starting a team, if I'm drafting, I'm staying so far away from Julius Randle. It's really funny to me, after the year was suspended, there were these reports of his teammates being like, just anonymous quotes being like, we did not enjoy playing with Julius Randle. And if you've ever watched the New York Knicks player, if you watched the Lakers play when he was there, he's not an enjoyable basketball player to be beside. I mean, he'll flash vision. Mostly he's a black hole. Mostly he has this weird confidence in his jump shot that is just so undeserved. I've seen some of the worst shots I've ever seen NBA players take launch from his broken form. It's just a lot of, when people are talking about empty calories, this is exactly what they mean. He does very, very little to impact winning. And I think people know that by now, but for those that don't, this is why he's on the overrated list.
Yeah, and I think that fantasy basketball players might tend to stick to him just a little bit longer than most, right? Because I'm sure he's producing pretty well in fantasy basketball. And that's another thing where I think it's easy to overrate guys based off those box score stats, because if you're a fantasy player and he's on your team and like he's helping you, he's contributing to wins there, but not wins in real life, it's easy to kind of excuse him and say, oh, it's the Knicks' fault, not his fault. I would say the most offensive pre-draft commentary I've ever heard in my entire life was people wanting to compare Zion to Julius Randle. I'm not sure anything made me madder or more angry or more personally just like, you know, make my skin crawl more than
that. I have another one. People who compared Julius Randle to Draymond Green. I don't want to say that. I'll just say it.
Like,
but I'm not
Luke
sure.
Walton.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. I wasn't positive if he did ever say that. But it's just like, what are we even talking about? Like, one is one of the worst defenders in the league and one is an all-timer.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good thought, right? It's like, okay, we have an undersized guy who we could probably maximize his utility at the five if we can just teach him to have a huge motor defensively and be a shot blocker and be unselfish offensively and shoot the occasional three and pass the basketball well and finish when called upon, then he can be Draymond Green. It's like, wait a minute, wait. That's like 15 things that we need to change about this guy. Like, that doesn't sound like a comparison at all.
The first real quick story time. When I covered the Lakers, the first question I ever asked Byron Scott in a press conference was if he would consider playing Julius Randle at the five. And he responded by smirking and then laughing for about three to five seconds. And that was, then we moved on to the next question. So that's just kind of.
So who was he making fun of? You, Julius, or both in that situation?
At the time, I read it as, oh, that was a pretty stupid question, even though we all know what happened to Byron Scott and his tenure and how he approached basketball strategy. But now it's, I think it might have been more like you really don't know what you have with Julius Randle if you think I can play him at the five, even if the league is going small as it is.
Right. It's like, okay, internet dork, you think you understand the trend, but you haven't watched Julius Randle try to protect the basket is basically where he was going with that. And probably in the back of his mind, he was like, yep, if I ever need to get fired, I should just play Randle at the five because we'll lose every game. all right. Any others on your list to wrap this thing up?
Sure. I have one more. Clint Capella.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I think Clint Capella will be fine in Atlanta. I think it's a good place for him playing beside Trae Young, and he really all he has to do is set screens and roll and jump, and he's capable of doing that. But I just in my mind have so many possessions where, particularly big time possessions against the Warriors in the playoffs, which might be a really high standard, but that's when the Rockets really needed him to come through, where, you know, he would get the ball either on a putback situation or he would be fed it by Chris Paul, not on a lob, and it would be, 5 feet away from the rim. And it was just like the most hopeless thing you've ever seen in your whole life. And if he finished or even drew a foul on some of those possessions, those really tight games, maybe they would have won and advanced. Who knows? Maybe it's unfair for me to just kind of single out those specific plays that I'm thinking of in my head. But like, I just always thought that also defensively, he was a little overrated. I mean, it's really cool that he can switch and execute their scheme as is, but like they were also pretty fine, I thought, when he was off the floor and you couldn't really play him at the end of in crunch time against some opponents in the playoffs. And so like, I don't know, maybe this is unfair, maybe this is a reach, but I've always just thought that Clint Capella was a bit overrated.
I could see it, especially because he didn't have the world's greatest season this year. I mean, he's not that number three guy on a title team, which is sort of like what you would look at when you look at their roster and salaries. Like last year during the Chris Paul year, you'd think, okay, like that's sort of how he lines up. Like he's got to be more important than PJ Tucker because of how much he's getting paid and everything else. But he never really performed on that level. And like you mentioned, a lot of times they had to pull him from the court just for matchups. I mean, I think that he could be falling victim to changing style stuff here too. I mean, obviously the first wave was like Roy Hibbert kind of getting knocked out of the NBA, right? The slow, plodding, rim-protecting guys who can't stretch are gone. And they're replaced largely by the Capella types, where you're just basically dunking on offense, diving to the hoop, rebounding, energy, and then defensively you're trying to protect the rim, but also hopefully switching, you know, at times. You're like slightly more versatile, but not completely versatile. And I wonder if we're just in a situation where like his value relative to the way the league is, the basketball is being played around the league is just in a natural decline here, regardless of how good he is as an actual player. You know what I mean? Like, I think that Capella 2 years ago is probably just a more valuable commodity than Capella 2 years from now, if that makes sense. And so just sort of like riding that decline. Would you agree?
I would 100% agree. And I always thought that he benefited just with what he was asked to do. He really benefited from playing with two of like the best lob throwers in the league, with Harden and CP. They just made him look so good. They set him up brilliantly. And imagining him coming of age in any other environment, I just don't think he ever gets anything close to that contract. I don't think his worth is anywhere near what it became. And so, again, I think he'll be okay with Trae Young, and I think the Hawks are fine in trying to get a player like that to build around Trae and try to kind of mitigate some of his weaknesses. But, like, all in all, Clint Capella was just, I thought, built up to be a little bit more than he's been.
Well, you mentioned Trae Young. I mean, I think that he's mandatorily on this list too. I mean, there's no way he should have started.
Oh, I knew that was coming. I knew that was coming.
And I don't want to dwell on that because we've had this conversation before. I think a lot of people have had it around the league. But he's just not an all-star starter. You know, he's a really good player. I think he's going to be a franchise player for a long time. I think it's even cool that he's going to connect with the fans and play in this horse game that you so despise that's about to be televised and everything else. But, I mean, come on. Not an all-star starter. We can just leave that one there. All right, Michael, I want your last one. Let's leave on a bang. What you got?
We've pretty much exhausted all of them, but I have a coach, and I don't even really want to say this person's name because I don't really believe it in my gut, but I wanted to put a coach on my list, and it was really difficult to try to find someone who was like a smart pick here, because I think a lot of coaches
you're really
good.
You're really going to call out Brad Stevens for not ever making the finals? Is that where you're going? Oh, where are you going?
Low key, the best defensive mind in the league. No, I I'm going with Terry Stotts.
Wow.
Come on,
Michael. He's been making lemonade out of lemons for years. I know. How are you going to do that?
No, it's literally just me trying to I don't even know. I'm answering a question here, and I'm trying to weigh what I believe is his public perception against what he's actually accomplished, and I can't even formulate a argument for why he's overrated, but he's also someone who just. He never is criticized in a way that I think a lot of other coaches on his level get criticism. I mean, we talked earlier about Mike D'Antoni, and granted, Terry Stotts never receives the praise that D'Antoni has throughout his career, but I don't know. There's been a lot of, I don't even know, man. I can't even are you just insulted that I threw his name out there? What do you think about do you get what I'm trying to even go for right now?
A little bit. I think he's basically properly rated because of what you just said.
Okay.
He doesn't get talked about enough. He doesn't get the hype, so he also doesn't get the criticism. They're just sort of off the radar, and it's like when they win, Dame gets all the credit, right? And when they lose, everybody trashes the roster, right? Or the GM. So Stotts is just sort of the undiscussed part of it. I think he's a really good coach. I think that there's been a couple seasons where they just way outperform my expectations, and I give him a lot of credit for personality management. His bond with Lillard is airtight. It has been the whole way, and I think that's the most important thing in modern coaching. Are you maximizing your best player's ability? So I give him a lot of credit there. I'm actually going to end this on a heater, Michael. I'm going to swing bigger than you, and I want to see what you think. Are you ready?
Oh, I was born ready.
Spurs front office, Greg Popovich, the GM, and RC Buford. I think that as of this moment right now, they are officially overrated. I think that everyone knows I'm a disciple of the Spurs monastery, have been for years and years and years, no question. The number of great moves they made along the way, legendary, right? I mean, just the timing to get the Duncan pick, finding Parker the way they found Parker, Manu Ginobili, maybe the greatest draft pick, you know, by slot in the NBA's history, right? I mean, go right down the list. Kawhi Leonard and the player development project. That trade, George Hill for Kawhi Leonard's laughable. I mean, laughable. What a deal, right? And of course, they had a long, long run of this. But we have a track record here now, basically the last 5 years since Duncan retired, that does not look very good. You talked about Golden State's ownership group not getting enough criticism for not keeping Kevin Durant happy. Look at the Kawhi Leonard trade. I mean, that thing has aged like the cheapest possible wine, you know, not fine wine, not anything Pop would be drinking around his, you know, $10,000 dinners with everybody. That's like boxed wine. That's how that one aged, and basically immediately, right? So they did not handle the Kawhi situation properly. I was okay with the LaMarcus move, but I'm not sure that's panned out as well as they wanted. The DeRozan situation to me has kind of been a mess, you know, sort of from the start. And then you look at their other, whether it's kind of recent draft picks, their other moves around the edges. I mean, there's been a few nice things here and there. I thought Rudy Gay actually, you know, panned out pretty well for them. Losing Davis Bertans the way they did, not great. And I just think that, you know, even – like Murray, DeJounte Murray, I'm fairly in on him. I thought the contract that they got for him was great, but I haven't seen him take necessarily the next step like I was hoping for, that big leap from a player development standpoint. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just sort of left wanting, a clearer direction, a return to sort of the Spurs archetype of player. I feel like that's maybe been muddied here a little bit over the last couple of years. And I think maybe, their reputation was just set at such a high bar. It's, impossible for anyone to live up to it. But I think that we've looked at a team that's just not been there for, 4 or 5 straight years. And there's definitely things you can question along the way.
I think that, yeah, no, this is, I agree generally with everything that you said. I'll push back on the LaMarcus Aldridge signing. I think that was a coup when it happened.
I agree. I'm just, what I'm saying is, did they get as much from that as they thought? Because when they made that deal, I thought, this is going to be this little, like the next baton handoff, right? Duncan's going to take him under his wing. It's going to solidify another 5 years of Kawhi and LaMarcus together as this core group that can just consistently compete for titles and everything else. And their roster has just been nowhere near that here over the last couple of years.
No.
And by the way, both these guys are obvious Hall of Famers, certified.
Sure.
They're above really any criticism. They've earned every right. I just think that they get every pass still, and they probably will get every pass until the end of time, and from sort of the national media and the general population. And it just hasn't been that pretty for the last couple of years. That's really my only point.
No, for sure. I think they've had, it begins and ends, so I think, with the Kawhi Leonard trade, and not only having to trade Kawhi Leonard, who, in my opinion, is the best basketball player alive, but putting yourself in a situation where you only get back Jakob Poeltl and DeMar DeRozan. Like, that's just a really tough pill to swallow. And I know that their back was against the wall in a lot of different ways, and there were a lot of question marks about Kawhi's health and his contract situation that made moving him so tricky. But when you combine that with, I guess, just like the on-court stylistic decision-making that has taken place, where they just don't want to be a part of the three-point revolution, yet defensively they want to stop the three-point revolution. So it's like that contradiction has been very confusing to watch unfold over the past couple seasons. And lastly, when a player like DeJounte Murray, who they were extremely high on, I was extremely high on before last season, when he tears his ACL in the fashion that he did with the poor timing that injury was suffered, that's also just like a kind of a death blow that not a lot of teams can come back from. And his season this year has been really disappointing coming back from the injury. So hopefully he can bounce back. But like you said, the Kawhi Leonard thing is really tough, and I agree with you that they're overrated at this point.
Yeah, they're victims of their own success too, right? I mean, how many other front offices now have former Spurs guys running this show? I mean, a lot of their brain power has kind of leaked out into other organizations. That's tough to keep up with, right? It's a constant challenge year after year after year, and if everybody's turned into your organization for 8 straight summers, peeling off your assistant GMs or your director of player personnel or whoever, eventually that's going to add up. Very fascinating to see. We're watching the Bulls kind of use this coronavirus crisis as a transition period, and there was scuttlebutt. Hey, what's Popovich going to do? Is this going to be his last season? Is he going to come back? I mean, is this an organization that could be in for a transition once this thing blows over, or do they try to just roll it out for one more year with the same group, or what do they do? I mean, to me, it's one of the kind of the fundamental organizational type questions that we have around the league right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great point. The Spurs brain drain, and I think a lot of teams around the league just copying what they do in terms of, be it international scouting or just snatching up the exact personnel that was making the decisions for the Spurs. I'm doing this piece, I don't want to step on it at all here, that I've been reporting for basically the entire season about chemistry, and the Spurs, one would assume, come up a ton in the story. And just like the influence that they've had, but then also when at least a third of the league you could say directly came from the Greg Popovich, RC Buford tree, they then, as you said, they do the exact same things that San Antonio was doing, and the competitive advantages that the Spurs had for so long, they just disappear.
For sure. Well, Michael, good news. We've set a record. We've talked for almost 80 minutes about one question sent in from our guy, Harry. We have like 35 more questions to get to, but we're not going to do it today. Guys, check us out on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael's on Twitter and Instagram at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver. On Twitter at Ben Golliver. We will be back next week with all of those great unanswered questions, but keep them coming. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. Guys, I know we angered you with somebody that we included or somebody that we forgot to include, so be sure to give us the follow-up on your own personal most overrated list. All right, Michael, I'm sure we're not going to get any blowback on this one whatsoever. Until next week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC Health/whatsyourwhy.